Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, June 24th. I'm Josh Golden, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, veterans rally for original plan as costs rise for Garberville Vet Hall project. Demand to keep carriers of last resort spurs rules review. And Mendocino groundwater fees set. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. At tomorrow's regularly scheduled Humboldt County Supervisors meeting on June 25th, the Department of Public Works will provide an update on the Garberville Veterans Hall project. County leaders are set to discuss how to proceed with the project as costs have risen. The original plan is now estimated to be over budget. One proposed alternative is to downsize and simplify the hall. However, the local chapter of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, VFW, is urging supervisors to adhere to the original plan and move forward with construction. The John B. Haynes Memorial Veterans Hall initially closed in 2016 due to deferred maintenance by the county that led to black mold, was demolished in 2023 with high hopes of building a modern version of the hall.
They just keep kicking us down the road, and they got to commit and get on with it.
That was Doug Battles with the local VFW chapter 6354.
I've been trying to get the county to pay attention to this, along with a few other veterans, for almost 4 years now. And it's getting really old. It took a couple of years before they would pay attention to us.
In 2021, the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors approved staff to move forward with the hazardous materials abatement and demolition of the existing Garberville Veterans Hall and proceed with the design of a new Veterans Hall with an anticipated total budget of approximately $3.1 million. Demolition of the building was completed in August 2023, and although the demolition itself was completed under budget, the schematic design created in January of this year was determined to be significantly over budget. In response to the increased costs attributed to inflation, the construction company, ORW Architecture, proposed a variety of cost reduction measures that would simplify the structure. Battles stated that the county aims to modify the original plans to curb the additional costs arising from inflation. The initial, more comprehensive design is projected to require an extra $3.5 million, while the downsized version estimated at $2.7 million. Battles, along with his fellow veterans, staunchly supports the original plan, which promises better facilities and the possibility of installing solar panels.
It's been 2 years since they said okay, and they allocated us $3.1 million to build our hall. Now, in the 2 years since that, the cost of the hall has gone up another $3.1 million. So it is basically, or 3.5 actually, and it has doubled in what it's going to cost to replace the hall.
The downsized version would also reduce the building's capacity by over 25%. Local veterans are calling for the county to fulfill its responsibility to address the neglect that caused the previous building's deterioration and believe that the extra investment would benefit the overall community into the future.
But it's going to be cutting corners where before were, you know, it made it pretty nice and very nice for the community. So the veterans are pushing the original plan and asking for the 3.5 because we want a building that will last for another 50 or 60 years.
Before its closure, the Garberville Veterans Hall served as a community gathering space for local dance classes, extreme winter shelters, holiday dinners, and political forums. He noted that it is also a safe space for veterans who are at a significantly higher risk of suicide compared to the general public and are disproportionately affected by homelessness.
There has been a huge hole in the veterans community here for a good 8 years because we don't have the hall. It's a shame that they can't go in to a place where they feel welcome, get the help that they need. I was helped so much by them because they actually, the Veterans Center in Eureka, would send down counselors to Southern Humboldt on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And they had to meet in the kitchen, but still they had a place to help the local veterans get through what they're getting through.
In closing, Battles says members of the local veteran community will be rallying at the Humboldt Supervisors' Chambers to share their concerns and desires for the future of the Garberville Veterans Hall. The agenda for tomorrow's supervisors' meeting, as well as the remote teleconference details, can be found at humboldtlegistar.com.
Please be involved. The community is the only thing that we have fighting for us. The county kind of has all the other cards. And we want to point out that we need a decisive action by them.
KMO News will bring you the highlights from tomorrow's supervisors' meeting later this week. Also on tomorrow's supervisors' agenda is a new access agreement with Half Moon Pictures, LLC. This agreement will allow for the filming of deputy sheriff staff while on duty for a docuseries called On Patrol Live, which will be filmed in real time and aired live. County staff have issued a recommendation for the collaboration. KMO News will bring you more on this in a later newscast. A state commission's rejection of AT&T's request to drop landline phone services showed that reliability is important to rural residents, and an update of the rules on service provider obligations will soon be underway. Daniel Mintz reports.
In the wake of rejecting AT&T's bid to drop landline communication service, the California Public Utilities Commission, or CUPC, will review its rules for carriers of last resort. At its June 20th meeting, the CPUC voted to dismiss AT&T's request, heeding demands of those who said loss of landline service would leave them in the lurch during emergencies when state-of-the-art technology is iffy. In a related decision, the agency voted to launch a review and update of its Carrier of Last Resort, or COLR, rules. Commissioner Darcy Houck said revised, updated rules will adapt to new conditions.
Earlier today, we dismissed AT&T's application. However, by initiating this rulemaking, we also recognize that communications landscape has changed significantly since the last update to the COLR rules. While the technologies that people rely on change, we want to ensure that our guiding principles remain those of universal service, ensuring the availability of affordable, reliable communication services that will function for all Californians. The rulemaking we're initiating today will consider whether and how to revise our COLR rules. In addition to determining whether the COLR rules are still necessary, we'll determine whether other service providers such as VoIP or wireless providers can be callers. We do not undertake this rulemaking lightly.
Commission President Alice Reynolds said the AT&T situation has demonstrated public demand for protecting telecommunications services. She said the rulemaking review can lead to better access to broadband services.
The rules reflect the public's expectation that all utility services be dependable. And we have heard significant support for these protections from the public, elected officials, and emergency responders. But many things have also changed. Changes have occurred in the telecom industry since the rules were enacted nearly 30 years ago. We know that many people have shifted from landline service to cell phone service, and cell phone service has become ubiquitous. Additionally, newer technologies such as cable, fiber, and fixed wireless and satellite offer competitive services to the traditional large monopoly telephone companies. But most importantly, our mandate to provide Californians with universal service has evolved to include access to high quality and affordable broadband services. I am very supportive of opening this rulemaking. I'm hopeful that the COLR requirements and the high cost funds will evolve to meet the long-term needs of Californians, and especially those Californians that remain without sufficient broadband service. So I'm hopeful that through this new rulemaking, we can really modernize these programs and move towards the future to meet our broadband for all objectives.
There was public anxiety over AT&T's request to drop landline service, but there wasn't much suspense leading up to the meeting. That's because the CPUC telegraphed its intent on May 10th when it released a statement saying AT&T, quote, did not meet the requirements for COLR withdrawal and, quote, failed to demonstrate the availability of replacement providers. At the meeting, landline users doubted whether they could count on cellular service in emergencies. A Mendocino County resident was one of several people who described landline phone service as essential to them.
I am asking you to not allow AT&T to decommission copper landlines and to keep our landlines. As a disabled senior, it's my lifeline and I need it. And I appreciate you for hearing me today and hope you will vote to make them keep our landlines and take care of the copper lines. Thank you so much, and I appreciate you very much. Thank you again. Goodbye.
Others described cellular reception as extremely spotty. A resident of Sonoma County said without landline service during the 2019 Kincade fire, quote, we would not have known about the evacuation and the extremely serious fire that went through here and took out most of our property. Several speakers said they're sensitive to electromagnetic frequencies and would get sick if they used cell phones. The CPUC's vote to reject AT&T's application was unanimous, but it could be superseded by the state legislature. A new bill, Assembly Bill 2797, would let AT&T and other last resort carriers drop services that are shown to lack viable customer bases or are duplicative. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Metz.
Turning to Mendocino, Mendocino sets its groundwater fees. KZYX's Sarah Reith shares this report.
The Ukiah Valley Groundwater Sustainability Agency agreed Tuesday on a fee schedule to carry out the regulatory requirements of SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act of 2014. According to that law, all groundwater basins in the state of California are supposed to be managed by a groundwater sustainability agency, which is charged with preventing a half dozen undesirable conditions in the groundwater basins. These include degradation of water quality, subsidence, and depletion of both groundwater storage and surface water. The Ukiah Valley, which sustains about a quarter of the people in the county, is considered a medium priority basin. Its population is around 20,000 people, 16,607 of whom live in the city of Ukiah. The agency is currently funded by its members, each of which pays $68,750 per year plus $30,000 in fiscal year 2025 to fund the fee study. The four members are the County of Mendocino, the City of Ukiah, the Russian River Flood Control Water Conservation and Improvement District, and the Upper Russian River Water Agency. There's also one seat each for agricultural and tribal interests. The yearly budget for the agency is $600,000. Administrative functions and developing the groundwater sustainability plan were funded by a grant from the State Department of Water Resources. The fees will be collected with property tax bills, unless the owner doesn't get one. In that case, the agency will bill the owner directly. Federal lands and tribal properties are exempt. There's also an appeals process. A representative of the Yokeo tribe, which is not federally recognized and which serves 75 water users, told the agency board that the community is disadvantaged and working on getting federal recognition. The board asked him to write a letter to that effect and signaled that they were receptive to the idea of exempting the tribe from the fees. The fee structure has two components. One is an annual fee of $4 per acre, which all property owners in the basin are supposed to pay. That's to cover administrative costs, or 23% of the agency's budget. The second component is broken into four groups, or categories, of water user. People using public water systems will be charged a little over 1 cent per 1,000 gallons extracted. Their water service provider will receive the bill on their behalf and likely pass it on to them. Cropland will be charged $32.75 per acre. That includes cannabis, which is capped at 1 acre. According to the fee study, properties with small cultivation licenses were not included in the fee study because water use in the maximum allowable canopy of a small cultivation license is similar to that of having a vegetable garden or a second home on the property. Of the 50 properties in the county with at least one valid cannabis license, 27 of them are considered cropland, according to the Department of Water Resources. According to the fee study, there are 18,550 acres of cropped land in the Ukiah Valley groundwater basin. Over 15,000 acres of that is vineyard. According to the last crop report, which was in 2021, agriculture generated $200 million that year. Just under $84.5 million was from grapes, followed by forest products at $67.1 million. Mendocino County ranks 35th out of 58 counties in the state in terms of agricultural production value. Agriculture, forestry, fishing, and hunting are responsible for 2% of the jobs in the Ukiah Valley and 6% of the jobs in the county overall. Cropland in the Ukiah Valley Basin uses 67% of the extracted groundwater, while public water systems use 31%. A third group that will be assessed consists of improved property that's neither cropland nor served by a public water system. This group will be charged $34.67 per acre per year. Residential properties in this group will be capped at half an acre. Ukiah City Councilmember Doug Crane said he's not a fan of how much of the fees fall on ag.
This is a regulatory burden, mandated regulatory burden. It has nothing to do with how much water anybody actually uses, where it came from. We're saddled with this obligation no matter what. Going through the math, presuming the acreage charge, if I've done this correctly, typical residential lot that may be 5,000 square feet, and apply that to a tax bill, pennies, not even dollars. And I think that the residential uses, I think there's room for more of that regulatory cost there.
Adam Gaska, representing the Farm Bureau, agreed in part.
There is a basis in the methodology, and it goes back to our own groundwater sustainability plan. You know, we stated that that is our best estimate for now, that agriculture is using roughly 2/3 of the groundwater. So then that's part of what we have to achieve, is making this as equitable as possible. I mean, we can do that. And I do agree. I've run through the numbers, and it shows that if we assume everything, and especially if we add more data, like what is being reported by agriculture of using groundwater for farming, and surface water, then we know that actually it's probably over-exaggerated, it's overestimated. But then all we would end up doing is shifting the cost to somebody else. We're
saddled with the cost as a greater community,
yeah.
Period.
The fees can be adjusted with proper notice and hearings once a year because they're attached to the property tax bill. Supervisor Glenn McGordy, representing the county, said he thought the newly adopted fee structure is a good place to start.
And that's been the attitude of the board. We know it's not perfect, but we have to get the mechanism in place to do the management, do the studies, collect the money, and adjust if necessary. So I think we're meeting that task with this study. We're fortunate to be in a place where our groundwater seems to be sustainable. There isn't a big fluctuation in elevations of groundwater from year to year, even during the drought. So we seem to be pretty good at recharging, which is really helpful for us.
For KZYX News, I'm Sarah Wright.
In national news, labor and environmental groups petitioned FEMA for extreme heat and wildfire disaster status.
Jane Sue is Energy Justice Director with the Center for Biological Diversity. She says that as the frequency and intensity of extreme heat and wildfire events keep increasing, states and local governments are having difficulty meeting the challenge. And that's where FEMA could step in with funding for projects to help keep people safe.
It includes cooling centers, air filtration and air purifying centers, really these kind of community resilience hubs.
Jean Sue says FEMA dollars could also be used for modernizing and upgrading local infrastructure to make them more resilient to extreme heat and smoke.
We advocate for rooftop and community solar and storage, especially in low-income communities and worker communities who don't have the upfront capital to get that.
Sue says solar capacity has already come in handy when the grid fails during extreme weather-related events.
What we've seen is that in places that have disasters like California, but also Puerto Rico in the southeast, families that had rooftop solar or community solar in storage were able to keep that electricity on despite the disasters. They weren't dependent on the brittle grid.
Under the Federal Stafford Act, FEMA steps in to assist states and local jurisdictions when they ask for federal assistance to deal with things like floods, earthquakes, and hurricanes. The coalition of more than 30 organizations is asking for the Stafford Act to also apply to extreme heat and wildfire smoke. Christine Bolaños is communications director at Workers' Defense. She says people who work outside or on the front lines of exposure to extreme heat and wildfire smoke, and she says they tend to be from low-income communities of color. Bolaños says having FEMA as a backstop in states like Texas with weaker labor protection laws would make a big difference.
If there were a federal heat standard, we feel like there would be much more of a sense of urgency and standards of accountability for employers to follow.
The coalition includes groups like the AFL-CIO, the Arizona Public Health Association, and dozens of other labor and environmental groups. Some states and local governments also plan to add a letter of support to the petition in the coming weeks. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
President Biden signs order protecting 500,000 undocumented people married to U.S. citizens from deportation. Christopher Martinez reports.
President Joe Biden announced his new program for undocumented spouses at an event he and the First Lady held to commemorate the 12th anniversary of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. But first, the president listened as Dr. Jill Biden gave the opening speech in the East Room of the White House. She told the crowd, Joe is doing what he always does.
Today, Joe is helping our country continue reaching for the dream of America. With our different backgrounds and beliefs, each of us makes our nation and remakes it in big ways and small ones. We are millions of individuals that add up to something so much bigger than any one of us.
Eventually, the president did get his chance.
My name's Joe Biden. I'm Jill Biden's husband.
Before talking about his new program, Biden spoke of his recent executive order aimed at securing the border by shutting down certain asylum applications at the border, recalling that he also said he would announce further steps to make immigration more fair and just. One step, he says, involves the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that he and then-President Barack Obama put into place 12 years ago. That program allowed work permits and protections from deportation for some undocumented youths who were brought to the U.S. as children.
So today I'm announcing new measures to clarify and speed up work visas to help people, including dreamers, who have graduated from U.S. colleges and universities, landed jobs in high-demand, high-skilled professions that we need to have grow, to see our economy grow. It's the right thing to do.
That was one step. But then he announced another. One that will affect some 500,000 undocumented residents who are married to U.S. citizens.
The second action I'm announcing today is about keeping families together.
This action involves undocumented spouses who, he says, on average have lived in the U.S. for 23 years, living in fear of deportation and unable to legally work. He says, we can fix that, and that is what I will do. Under the new program, an undocumented spouse who has been here for at least a decade can file for legal status and get work authorization without having to return to their home country with no certainty of being able to re-enter the U.S. Biden says this is a better way because it does not tear families apart.
The action I'm announcing today will go into effect later this summer. And by the way, just as was true for the protection of dreamers, the steps I'm taking today are overwhelmingly supported by the American people, no matter what the other team says. In fact, polls show over 70% of Americans support this effort to keep families together.
Biden's actions were met with quick applause from immigrant rights activists. The Los Angeles-based group Siren, Services, Immigrant Rights and Education Network, praised the Biden order as much needed and welcome action, while going on to call for further actions like expanded visa programs and faster asylum processing. The National Domestic Workers Alliance calls the action a big deal for domestic workers and also a big deal for the nation's care infrastructure. On the other hand, the new action comes just 2 weeks after another Biden executive order, a border crackdown that largely shut the southern border to asylum seekers. That move was blasted by immigrant rights activists. The back and forth on border issues may or may not have a political effect in the upcoming presidential elections. Biden did make some pointed comments on his presumed Republican opponent, former President Donald Trump, saying Trump is playing on people's fears about the border.
These are the fears my predecessor is trying to play on when he says immigrants immigrants, and his words are poison the blood of the country. When he calls immigrants, in his words, animals. When he was president, he separated families and children at the border. And now he's proposing to rip spouses and children from their families and homes and communities and place them in detention camps. He's actually saying these things. It's hard to believe it's being said, but he's actually saying these things out loud. And it's outrageous.
The new executive order will definitely have a big effect on undocumented residents and communities, like Javier Quiroz Castro, a speaker at the White House event. He's a dreamer who was brought to the U.S. when he was 3 years old. He went on to get a nursing degree in Tennessee, and now he works for the largest hospital system in Texas.
Being a nurse has allowed me to give back to my community while supporting my family, especially during the pandemic. I helped take care of patients in our COVID-19 critical care unit. Saving American lives was only possible because of DACA. It allowed me to live and work and build a family in the only country I have ever known and loved.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Lauren Schmidt, Sarah Reith, Max Pringle, and Christopher Martinez. KMUD News is online. You can find us at kmud.org. SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Josh Goldberg.